The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, and Chicago. And if you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees. This evening, we are bringing you an encore presentation of two of my all-time favorite interviews, one with Ross Schaefer, the original founder of Salsa Cycles, and one with Richard Schwinn. Both of these conversations were aired back in August of 2011. Both are just delightful. We will be back next week with a brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. So please sit back and enjoy our first guest, from August 27, 2011, Ross Schaefer. Ross Schaefer, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Well, thanks for having me, Diane.
So I want to learn more about Ross Schaefer. Where did you grow up? What did you do that turned you into another one of those guys with the bicycle gene?
The bicycle gene.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up in Southern California, Orange County, the heart of republicanism in California. And it was a beautiful agricultural world then when I was a little guy. And I lived in the middle of an orange grove, and everywhere you looked was orange groves as far as you could see. So driving from my house to, say, Anaheim, where Disneyland was, was one of those, okay, kids, go to the bathroom. We're going to Disneyland. You know, we're going to be in the car for a while because there weren't freeways. You just drove, you know, through these little country lanes and stuff, through the orange groves, and it was a blast. Living in an orange grove, are you kidding?
Freeways? Really?
There were freeways, but they were few and far between. They weren't just, you know, like the spider web that it is now.
Right, right.
So there wasn't an on-ramp, you know, every mile and a half from wherever you lived in Southern California. It was quicker to go on surface streets to Anaheim, which was about 10 miles away, 10, 12 miles away from where I grew up.
So you started riding a bike when?
I started riding a bike at my cousin's house in Palmdale. They couldn't believe I didn't know how to ride a bike. I could barely make a tricycle go around. And I think I was 8 years old.
Wow.
They got me riding a bike out in front of their place. And then that same summer, we went and visited my relatives in Utah. And they had this little 20-inch girls' bike in their garage, another family of all girls. And I spent the entire week that we were at my Aunt Jax's doing laps of their block on that little girls' bike and catching crap from all the other little boys on the block because I was riding a girls' bike. I didn't even know what they were talking about.
Exactly.
It was difficult to me. And I was having a blast. It's like, Ross, come in. Come in. Come in. One more time around. That was my first just getting lost in bicycles. And then it was that wonderful week of just riding laps around the block. I think back on it, and it was kind of silly because I really did almost nothing else.
That's not silly. That's how you immerse yourself in something. I like that.
I guess.
Yeah.
I was immersed anyway.
Yeah. And so from there, they probably had to go buy you a new bike, huh?
Well, no, still didn't buy a bike. But for my 10th birthday, I got a shiny new Schwinn Stingray with a 2-speed kickback Bendix hub.
No way!
Rod. Oh, yeah. And a fairly rare model at that.
A 2-speed kickback, yeah.
I was in love.
I'll bet.
You know, my sister got a bike on the... It was my birthday, but my sister got a bike on the same day, too, which kind of pissed me off, of course, but since it was my day. But she got just a regular kind of 26-inch, 26x1⅜ wheel, single-speed kind of thing, and it was like, how did you get a bicycle on your birthday? At least it's not a Stingray. Mine's cool, and yours isn't.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
So I was just head over heels in love with my bike and rode it every chance I got. And then really quickly after I got that bicycle, I got a paper route. And that's when bikes sunk into my life. That's when I became a mainliner. I didn't grow up in a very happy household. And we were also really quite poor, so it wasn't all that pleasant a place to be. And the paper route gave me freedom, plain and simple.
Along with the two wheels.
Along with the two wheels. You know, the paper route gave me the financial freedom.
Right.
You know, making my whole $15 a month or whatever I made. And the bicycle gave me the transportation freedom.
So put that in time for me. I know you were 10. What years are we talking about?
We're talking 1965.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah.
And at this time, Orange County had transformed from this lush, orchard-laden heaven to becoming just the armpit of the world and becoming just a concrete-covered hole. I won't mince words. There was development going on everywhere,
yeah.
And they were tearing out all the orange groves.
Really? But there are still
just
orange groves.
Them out right and left.
There are still some orange groves.
There are still some down there, but they're very rare and very few and far between.
Huh.
It was named Orange County because it was covered in citrus groves.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, it certainly does add up. So
yeah.
Did your family stay there? Now you're 10.
So, and we moved to an area where there was yet more development than there was, you know, 4 miles away where I was living. And guess what happens when you're building tract houses just all over the place? You end up with these empty lots with big piles of dirt.
Really?
You have any idea why BMX was born in Southern California?
Because every place you look, there were big empty lots with piles of dirt.
Big empty lots with piles of dirt.
Awesome.
So I proceeded to beat the crap out of my bike and myself over and over and over again. And a little technical note here, 2-speed kickback Bendix hubs do not take that kind of treatment very well. They're actually a fairly dainty little hub there. So
hence freewheeling, it sounds like a better idea.
Freewheeling would have been a better idea, but I had a paper route, so I just kept paying to have the thing rebuilt and fixed. And then the one time I tried to fix it myself, I didn't know which end of a wrench to use. I was not a mechanical kid.
Really?
And my best friend, Richard, who just called me yesterday out of the blue, for instance, he was quite mechanical, and he said, I'll rebuild that for you. They charge $7.50 at the shop. I'll do it for $5. And it cost me about $20 to get it fixed after I paid him $5 because he put in a bunch of bearings backwards and he'd never taken apart a 2-speed hub. And
neither have most of the people who are working in the bicycle business today.
That's right.
Yes.
That's absolutely right.
Yes.
But so that was my first kind of real slam dunk lesson. That and my first attempt at truing wheels. Those were my two big lessons on, hey, you know, you need to learn about this crap before you just dive in and do it.
Yeah, that's true. There's nothing more dangerous than an amateur with a spoke wrench.
That's right. Actually, the first bike shop I worked in, this is a really funny story. The first bike shop I worked in, the boss always gave customers free spoke wrenches when they bought a new bike. And I said, Miles, what are you doing? That's crazy. That kid doesn't have a clue. He's going to ruin his wheel. And he said, that's right.
Now it's the conversation was over.
And I went, oh, that's right. This is business.
That is hilarious.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it is funny.
I love that.
All right. So now let's fast forward a little bit. You got to go to high school sometime.
I went to high school. I got big time into bikes in high school for a short time because I got in a fight with my parents about a haircut.
You
of
didn't,
all things.
You didn't want one, and they wanted you to have one.
Oh, man, you are just right on top of it. So they insisted I get a haircut. I told them, no way. They said, but they had the big hammer over my head, and they said, well, we happen to know that your insurance is coming up because we talked about it with you last week, and we know that you don't have the money saved up for it, and we're not loaning it to you unless you get a haircut.
Oh,
and
nice.
I had about half the money for my insurance.
And this is car insurance we're talking about.
This is car insurance.
Got it.
Which was an entire, you know, like a whopping $190 a year.
Hey, in 19 whatever, that was a lot of money.
For a 16-year-old, are you kidding?
Mm-hmm.
That was forever's worth of wages. I couldn't save that kind of money.
Right.
And so I had about half of that saved. And I was on a trip with my family in Utah, and we got into this big fight about it because I was saying, hey, you know, when we get home, I need to borrow money, and they're going to get a haircut, and you'll do it. And I'm not going to get a haircut. Come on, you can't hold me hostage like this.
Yeah,
and
they
I got
could.
Pissed off. I walked from my sister's house. This is in Provo, Utah. I walked from her house about 3 or 4 miles to a bike shop and bought a bike and rode the bike home to my sister's house. And my parents were going, what's this? And I said, screw the insurance. Screw cars. I'm just going to ride my bike.
Good for you.
And they just, well, how the hell is that getting home? And I said, I'll tie it to the roof. Don't worry. We'll get it home. And for about the next 6 or 7 months, while I saved up enough money to get
car
insurance, you know, I got more serious about savings. I just used my bike. I rode to work on my bike. I rode to see my girlfriend every afternoon on my bike. And she didn't live close by either. So it was, and that you know, sunk the needle in deeper. It's like, oh, I can transport. And I had fun racing against the cars downtown and all that kind of stuff. Big fun. So I, you know, it's like, oh, bicycles are really viable transportation in the city, too. And I learned that pretty young.
So are you an engineer?
No.
I love the way you said that.
I've taken a few classes at junior colleges.
That was awesome that you just said no. That's so cool.
But graduated high school.
Yeah, me too. So you bought the Proteus frame building kit.
Yep.
In 1976, you built your first road bike in 3 months.
Yep.
And you worked for Santana.
I went on to work for Santana.
So you left Santana, and then you thought you'd become the custom tandem king, and you came out with something I've never heard of, Red Bush. Tell me about this. I got to know. I'm a stoker. Come on. Tell me about this tandem.
Well, the tandems, you know, I built one Red Bush tandem before I started working at Santana. I'd started Red Bush in 70, like late 76, early 77 or something, and was building single bikes and built this one tandem for a bike shop in Santa Cruz that wanted to buy three tandems. And they ordered three tandems from me. I built this one, delivered it to them, and said, I don't want to build your other tandems. I don't want to build tandems. I nearly quit frame building over that first tandem.
Believe that.
It was so difficult, and I hadn't a clue what I was doing. So I built that first tandem. Fortunately, it actually worked pretty good. It's at a museum. It's in North Carolina at the Mountain Bike Museum down there.
How cool is that? Well, you know what? If I go to North Carolina, I specifically want to go see that.
Yeah. Anyway, I built those lugless bikes. Again, didn't have a clue what I was doing. I'd been a silver soldering lug builder up until then. And I got this opportunity to work down at Santana through kind of a weird set of circumstances and just never looked back. Got my lugless stuff down, got tandems totally dialed. I left Santana, thought I was going to be the custom tandem king because, oh, tandems aren't difficult at all now for me. I can build a tandem in no time, and I'm good at it, and I know what I'm doing. But this was before I was doing, I was selling a little bit of wholesale, but I was mainly selling just directly to customers.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of odd tandem customers. As you own a bike shop. You know
yes,
I
do, and it's a custom-only shop. I'll tell you what, dealing with tandem couples, oh, boy.
Ooh-wee.
Oh boy.
So I went through that a few times, and I went, I'm done with tandems. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to stand here again and listen to a guy lying to his wife about why they're buying the tandem. Because it was always to get her involved in cycling, too.
Right.
And this scenario happened to me twice, back to back, and that killed it for me. And the guy, I'd spend this time fitting him, fitting her, and going over what they're going to use the tandem for, all the basic, custom stuff.
Sure.
And then it was weird. It's like, are you guys on? Is there a book that tells you how to do this or something? At some point, the wife gets tired of bike talk and wants to go for a walk. I was in Santa Cruz. It's a beautiful place. Goes for a walk, and the guy goes, okay, so here's the deal. Me and my buddy are really going to be the person's, riding this tandem.
No kidding. I haven't run across.
And they gave me their buddy's measurements. And it's like, and they say, can you kind of hit between these? This is the guy I really needed to fit because we want to go out on the club rides and do freight trains and stuff.
I've never actually
You've never
run
had that happen?
No.
Know
what? Anybody listening out there, don't you come to me with this.
It's like, this is just too weird.
That is weird.
I refuse to do it.
Good for you.
I refuse to do it, and I built it to fit the ladies.
I think I would have given up on tandems if I had had that experience, too. That's pretty ugly.
So I just went, single bikes are so much easier, and I don't have to deal with this. Well, it's not really for her. It's in game.
Oh, that is hilarious. Let me take just one second to remind our listeners we're speaking with Ross Schaefer, who obviously has had quite an interesting bicycle history and still does. So let's fast forward a little bit.
Okay.
Salsa became sort of who you were and what you did, but it wasn't just bicycles. It was stems and it was bars. And I mean, these things still exist today, although you do not any longer own the company. Do you have any involvement in Salsa Cycles anymore?
No.
Okay. But we still sell a lot of and fit with Salsa bars.
Mm-hmm.
That Poco bar and the Short and Shallow and those are all really important tools for us, and we sell a lot of those. So you did us a real favor, and I appreciate that.
Right on. And those are designs that I worked on way back then.
Yeah, I can believe that. So you decided to only ever build, 5 mountain bikes or something like that? You said you're not interested. The only 5 mountain bikes that I will ever build, you relented to building them in 1982. Ha ha.
Yeah.
And you also built, looks like, Brian Bayless, a tandem.
I built Brian Bayless a tandem. Talk about a feather in my cap.
Really? When you look at
you to build a frame, are you kidding?
And look at Brian's work. It's only impeccable. So he must have really loved you.
Well, it was his frames that got me into frame building, period.
Okay. I mean, his stuff is magnificent.
And I went, wow, I can't afford $350 for a bike frame? Oh, you can buy a whole Mossy with Campy parts for $450.
Wow.
I'll just make one.
And so you did. So tell me about this whole mountain bike thing. I don't know nothing about mountain bikes. And here you are in the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame, dude.
Yeah, well, being the visionary that I am.
Uh-huh.
I saw no future in mountain bikes. I saw that first article in Bicycling with Joe Breeze with his Fu Manchu mustache, badass pushing his bike up through the woods, and it was an article by Charlie Kelly. But I read that article and said, "Oh, this is so cool! Look at that bike with the mixed stays. Oh, I love this kind of stuff." And I'd been cyclocrossing, not racing cyclocross, but riding off-road as much as possible on my road bike.
Okay.
Quite a bit, in fact. And this is before I moved up to Northern California. Well, I built my first frame in Northern California, then went south for a bike shop job that was offered to me. So this was happening down in Southern California. But I was looking at these bikes, and I'm going, yeah, but, nobody's ever going to make a good tire. Nobody's ever going to make a good rim, so why bother with those things? It's off-road on your road bike. It's got to be more fun because it's so sketchy.
Right, exactly. And dangerous.
And dangerous.
There you
and
have
hard
it.
To do.
And hard to do.
I was a macho guy. I was into breaking parts. And, look, I destroyed my wheel that I just built last week. Isn't that cool?
And I know how to true wheels.
And I know how to build new wheels. So I'll just build a new wheel, and I'll just build a new fork, or I'll just, whatever. It didn't bother me. It was like a macho badge or something to go break crap. And I just didn't see the thing with mountain bikes for me. I saw the first couple that I saw were for sure a Ritchie. And then went to a bike show in L.A., and all the mountain bikes in the world were at that bike show, and it was a Mantis, a Ritchie, a Mountain Goat, and a Victor Vincente, and those were the only mountain bikes, I think, in existence being, you know, attempting to be sold at
right.
that time, other than Breezers and Ritchies, which I knew of but didn't see. Well, I guess I did see the Ritchie at that show. Anyway, I didn't ride one of the Mantises, but it was the only bike that fell outside the norm of the day, which was the super slack kind of cruiser-type geometry. So I rode, you know, a couple of those bikes around the block. It was Ritchie in particular, and then shortly after those bikes came out, the Stump Jumper followed, and I worked at a bike shop, so and we sold those, and I, you know, would ride those, and it's like, God, these things just handle like pigs. I hate the way they handle. I bet they downhill really good, but you got to climb a hill too,
right?
You know? And I don't have buddies with trucks to take me up to the, you know, in Southern California, going up to the Long Hill was an all day kind of thing. even in a truck, it wasn't the backyard.
Right.
A nice downhill that they had in Tamalpais and stuff. So we had to consider riding up the stuff. And I just wasn't into it. They just felt like slugs to me. And then my buddies kept pressuring me to make them, and then I got my lugless experience, and they pressured me some more. And by then, some decent rims were trickling in, and I went, okay, yeah, I'll build some for you. But, you know, we have so much fun on our road bikes in the dirt. You're not gonna want these things. So I built them their bikes. I built myself one at the same time. I remember the day my tires came in the box, and nobody had any knobbies in stock at the time, and so all I could get was some big fat 2125 street tires, and my brand new mountain bike was just waiting there for tires. I mounted them up. It was like 9 at night. I drank a beer, went out my door, went out to the nearest golf course. Listeners, don't do this at home.
Oh, no. Here it comes. Road through the sand
traps. Because it was right
next
to the bike trail.
Yep.
Near where I lived. This is still in Southern California. And just had so much fun. I rode for hours in that golf course just doing the most lurid long slides you could imagine on the freshly watered lawn.
Ooh. Greenskeepers were out with guns looking for you, dude.
Yeah, the next day, I'm sure there was some. I've been paying for that for a long time. I've got a lot of bad karma.
Well, what kind of bikes did you make for Peter Gabriel?
They were mountain bikes. A buddy of mine lived in Woodstock, New York, and was kind of, sort of, Woodstock, New York is a little tiny town.
Oh, I've been there.
Pals with Tony Levin, who is the bass player for lots of people, including Peter Gabriel.
And King Crimson.
And King Crimson.
In the Court of the Crimson King, one of my all-time favorite albums.
But anyway, he called me up one day and said, hey, do you want to build some bikes for Peter Gabriel and his band? I went, are you kidding me?
Right.
I am such a huge Genesis fan. And this is, of course, long after he left Genesis and all that. But and I was big time into King Crimson, all that stuff. I said, are you kidding me? He says, yeah, they're doing a tour. They're taking this tour to Africa, and they don't want to take their Caldagos because they were all cycling nuts. And they had like a little covey of Moltons, and they had a little covey of Caldagos. And they're figuring, well, but Africa, we need something heavier duty, and they got these things called mountain bikes now. So I made them. They were a la carte. They weren't a custom bike so much, although I did some little custom tidbits on them. And the bad part of that whole story is that this is in the second year or third year of Campy's attempt to do mountain bike.
Ugh. And they wanted Campy parts on these
bikes? And they wanted Campy parts because they'd heard Campy was doing mountain bike parts.
And they were so bad.
Parts. And I'm saying, no, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. And they're going, well, how bad can they be? It's Campy. I'm going, well, this new stuff I think is better than the first stuff. But you know, Shimano's good. And it turned out I could get the Campy stuff for a song, and I couldn't get the Shimano stuff. So they said, get us the prices on both. And I got them the prices. They went, you mean the Campy's less expensive? We're going for it.
and they never...
You know what happened.
Yeah, they regretted it ever since.
They regretted it ever since.
Yep. That's too bad, too.
They ended up retrofitting their stuff to Shimano eventually.
Good boys.
And fortunately or unfortunately, Tony's bike actually ended up getting burnt in the barn. He was out on tour with Peter Gabriel or King Crimson, one or the other, and his barn studio burned down.
So oh no!
All his guitars got burnt, and
oh no!
And his salsa got burnt.
Oh!
They called me up and said, "I want another one, but can we put Shimano parts on it from the start this time?"
And you said, "Oh,
and I said, think Campy doesn't even make them anymore."
Exactly.
Of course.
So this is all then. Now
That's
we have
man.
Now, and you are doing some really, really cool things. Basically, what I discovered and what I think is true about you is you are an artist, that while you use your hands to make frames and parts and all those things, you have this artistic eye, because I saw 6ix9ine Design and I saw some of the things you're working on, and it's pretty amazing. Tell us about 6ix9ine Design.
6ix9ine Design is hey, what am I going to do? I quit my job with salsa. I didn't make enough from the sale of the company to retire. I got to do something. Well, I wore a lot of different hats building up, you know, my skills to run a business and all that, so I'll just hang out my shingle and do whatever. And I can't remember what my business card says, but... it says, I do anything. You know, if you got the money, I got the time.
Right,
or something
exactly.
Like that. And so 6ix9ine Design is really a company. It's just me, and I offer product design. I do production consulting. I do production sourcing. I do prototyping. I do fabrication. What do you need?
Well, right now,
if you'll pay my wage, I'll figure out how to do it for you. If I don't know how to do it, I'll see if I can learn it quick enough to get the job.
And now you're working on pedal steel guitars.
And now I've
how
got
cool
this dream scenario. I've always wanted to play pedal steel guitar because I've always loved the instrument. And over my lifetime, I've sat down at them a number of times. And I don't know if you've ever sat down to one or
no.
Know any players, but they are an absolute mind-bending instrument.
I love the sound. I love the sound.
Heavenly.
I know. I love it.
But they're very complex to figure out. And they have, you know, other than having strings and having something that looks like a fretboard.
It's not a regular guitar.
It's not a regular guitar by
it.
A long shot. And I've been playing guitar for a long time, albeit at a low, mediocre level. And I finally just... I was in a band, and we had this pedal steel player come in and sit in with us. We were doing some country rock stuff, and I could barely play the stuff that I knew really well because I was just so entranced by listening to the steel. And he left that night, and I said, "That's it. I'm getting a steel, and I'm going to learn how to play." So I bought myself a steel, and because they're a complete mechanical Rube Goldbergish beast.
Yeah.
I spent as much time, you know, messing around underneath them, under their skirts, so to speak, as trying to play the thing. And through a weird set of circumstances, due to a happy old bike frame customer, this guy calls me up one day and says, "Hey, I'm representing so-and-so who owns such-and-such steel guitar company, and we want to talk to you about working with us on a project."
There's no such thing as a coincidence.
What? Really?
Really.
So they came over and talked to me about it, and I thought it was just for fun. It was just a research kind of thing. And he said, "So how much would it cost us to get you to really focus on this and kind of, you know, not take in so much other work so we can really, you know, get your focus on it?" I'm going, "What? You mean pay?
You mean you're going to pay me to do something, my love? How nice is that?"
Well, pay me to do something that I was, you know, trying as hard as I could to find the time to squeeze in to do it myself. I was doing it myself, the same kind of research. I was doing all the exact stuff that I'm doing now for pay that I, you know, in my spare time.
Well, and that is very cool.
It's fantastic. So now I'm just doing a couple of little jobs for clients who are kind of grandfathered in, but most of my time is spent working for this, doing pedal steel guitar design and research, and we're seeing if I can come up with anything that's anything that's better than what's out there, or even as good.
Well, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. So Ross's life is good.
Yep, Ross's life is pretty good. I live in a pretty sweet place. I've got a fantastic wife. I've got the most awesome little farm in the world. It's a makeaholic's wonderland.
You just delighted me, so I know everybody listening is going to be delighted, and I am so excited that I got to talk to you and that we got to catch up. The last time I talked to you, you were making me some custom stems, and that was a bazillion years ago. So
a bazillion years ago.
It was.
Here's a little plug on custom stems. If you listen carefully on the phone, you might hear a die grinder going, and that's Sean Walling of Soulcraft Bicycles, and he builds frames in my barn. With a lot of the old salsa tools still. He was in charge of frame building in the last few years of under my ownership.
I know who Soulcraft is. That's awesome.
And he is going to start doing custom stamps soon.
So guess what? You are not out of the bike business, even though you think you are. You're still close to it.
I'm close to it, and I'm actually, I asked permission yesterday if I could give this out, but I'm doing some design work for your friend and mine, Richard Sachs, as well.
Oh, really? He was just on a few weeks ago.
I know.
Yeah.
That was a great interview. He's a
Thanks.
Great guy.
He is a great guy. And so, obviously, you're going to get involved in some cyclocross stuff.
Well, I'm working with him on some frame fittings and stuff.
Okay.
Have been for a few months. And I'm
awesome.
Sure they'll probably show up on cyclocross bikes.
All right. Ross,
right
unbelievable. That was so much fun.
Well, thank you, Diane.
Thanks
for having me.
And we'll catch up again soon.
Okay.
Have a good
Take
night.
Care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ross Schaefer's interview was originally aired on Saturday, August 27th of 2011. We'll be right back after a short break for my interview with Richard Schwinn, also from August of 2011.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of the Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees, and this week we are airing encore presentations of two interviews we did back in August of 2011. Here is my conversation with the venerable Richard Schwinn, as always a delightful guest. Richard Schwinn, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Well, thanks for having me on tonight.
So we go back a long way, and we've discussed a lot of issues. In fact, it's difficult to choose what to talk about and what to discard with you because you have so much information about so many things. We are going to take our moment, though, at the beginning and pay tribute to our favorite Labrador.
Well, our late favorite Labrador, Gunner the dog. And Gunner has actually been, we lost Gunner a couple of weeks ago. He lived a long and wonderful life. He went into retirement about 2 years ago and took up bird watching. in the backyard, and they did begin to tolerate him after a while. But Gunner, we picked up Gunner. This was actually the second Gunner that we bought, and the first Gunner was the reason we created a whole line of bikes called Gunner. And the first Gunner had some genetic problems, and we tried to fix them, and he died on the operating table. And
I do remember
tragic.
That, yeah.
And then we went out and found a breeder who happened to be in western Pennsylvania. And so my wife went and found it and proved once and for all that you can actually, with MasterCard, buy unconditional love.
And priceless.
So, and where was her first stop as she was bringing Gunner back home?
My house.
Indeed.
Yes, so we got to see baby Gunner first before anybody else did, except for Shu, and I think Anna Rose was with her at the time.
Anna Rose was leading. You got to see little Gunner before I got to see little
Just
Gunner.
Just the cutest little boy on the planet. He was so cute. And then we took him to the store, and we took a picture of him with a Gunner bike.
And he's been an appropriate symbol for all the things we love about Gunner bikes. And so we're going to miss him, but he was a good dog, and life will go on.
Yes, it will. So that's our little tribute to Gunner the dog. We still have Gunner's the bikes.
Indeed.
Okay. So let's get back to what we're going to talk about this evening. And I know that everybody knows the name Schwinn. I mean, I grew up with Schwinn. Everybody grew up with Schwinn. But Schwinn actually, while it's still your name, is no longer your business. Now you are Waterford Precision Cycles and Gunner Bikes.
Indeed. In fact, for me, that's now so long ago. We started in business over 18 years ago. And so the Schwinn is like the family company is a distant memory, and it's off there in the rearview mirror. We actually still do some occasional business with Schwinn. We built some Paramounts for them, and we'll probably end up having a continuing relationship. And they've gone on, and their products ebb and flow, as often happens. But we've gone out and created our own niche in the world, and that continues to develop. And it's been, in many respects, separating from Schwinn has really been good for our family personally. Our kids have really developed well as a result of seeing a small business instead of dealing with a really big one.
And Waterford, interestingly enough, still builds traditional steel frames.
We build traditional and untraditional.
Well, yes. Okay.
In fact, that's really one of the merits of steel is how much flexibility you have with it as a design material.
Yeah, say more about that.
The way most people in the bike world have defined innovation, they go, well, if we have a new material, that must mean we're innovative. Now, you may be actually building a design that functions exactly the way it did 70 years ago. But because it's got a new skin on it, it shows innovation. And in our case, we have been innovators in the underlying design of the bikes. Now, the truth is that steel as a material, the alloys of steel have evolved. I mean, what we build with is vastly superior than what we had 10 years ago, certainly 20 or 30 years ago. This is not the term steel can apply to everything from a 15-pound Schwinn Varsity frame to, bike frames that we build down close to 3 pounds.
Let me ask a real quick question. What's driving the new steel, these air-hardened, lightweight steel frames? What is it bicycles that is driving this new steel technology?
Well, the air-hardening steels is a generation of steels that actually came out of the aerospace industry when they needed something that was tougher than anything else out there. There's no match for steel, and they use the air hardening steels for F-16 landing gear, for example.
Okay.
Where you're talking about basically a controlled crash, but you want to reuse the whole plane, and so when you need it and you need it really tough, that's what steel does. And a lot of people don't appreciate it, but a bicycle is perhaps the most demanding structure that you can build, because there's not a lot of backup in a bike.
No, there isn't.
With a bike, you have no more than two tubes, and something ugly is going to happen. And so the whole goal is when we design a bike, we're really designing to a lot closer to the technical edge than an aerospace designer.
So today's steel bicycles are back in favor, which
they
is an interesting thing.
Favor, yeah.
Yes. Do you think that carbon will begin to fall out of favor as aluminum did?
Well, that's hard to say because, first of all, it all depends on where you see carbon and aluminum. I think aluminum bikes continue to sell by the millions. They just don't sell at the high end by the millions.
Okay, that's true.
You know, you're still, and the reason that they sell is that they're so bloody cheap. And they're cheap because they're subsidized material, and you can buy a frame that costs almost nothing from China. And the factory that makes it basically doesn't have to pay for their aluminum. The Chinese decided that they wanted to have expertise in carbon fiber. They did exactly the same thing. And so really the carbon fiber bikes are amazingly cheap for their relative performance. I don't think they're going to go away. If you need a mass-produced bike, the Chinese have developed an ICE engine for that. Now, the problem with carbon fiber is that carbon fiber is not very flexible. If you don't fit it, that's tough. And they don't care because the cost of even the Chinese building a custom carbon fiber bike is so high that that's just not business they want. And that's one of the areas where steel and other cut and weld materials, but I think from a metallurgical and a performance standpoint, steel is really good stuff.
Let me take 1 second to remind our listeners that we are speaking with Richard Schwinn. He's in Waterford, Wisconsin, and we're talking about frame materials and steel in particular. You also see a socioeconomic benefit of bicycles and bicycling.
Well, there is. But before we get to that, I want to bring up another phenomenon. I think the problem is steel is the devil we know. We know what its strengths and weaknesses are. And so what we don't know are the weaknesses of some of the other materials out there. In fact, really weight is the biggest downfall to steel compared with other materials. The thing is that weight turns out not to be that big a deal. When you are talking about comparing a 15-pound frame to a 3-pound frame, yeah, weight's a big deal. But when you're talking about comparing a 3-pound frame with a 2.5-pound frame, now the weight is just not a big factor. And I think what's happened is people who are in the know are rediscovering cycling. And I call the phenomenon the giggles. I have a friend, Matt, who was he was a dealer of ours for a long time, and he's since retired. And he, long time ago, sold a lot of steel bikes, Waterfords and Paramounts, and then he kind of disappeared from the world. And probably about 6-7 years ago, he called me up and he goes, "I want to tell you something. You know, I've avoided steel bikes for the last 10 years." I go, "I know this. I was hoping that wasn't the case." He goes, "That's true." But he goes, "I pulled out my Waterford, and I took it for a ride." And he goes, "All I could do as I was going on this ride is giggle. I haven't had that much fun on a bike in years. I've been struggling so much to achieve high technology that I forgot the real reason why I ride a bike."
What an interesting story, because I know that people who have that bike that is all yours and the way steel responds, you know, you get that kind of feeling from the road that you don't get from anything else.
Well, and I think a lot of people are beginning to recognize this more and come out to talk about that. I mean, you know, there's a great electronic publication, roadbikerider.com, and they've been putting out a newsletter for years. And you know, Fred Matheny, who was one of the pioneers of alternate materials, you know, he was an editor for Bicycling Magazine back in the early 80s and you know, sort of disappeared and sort of came back. This was kind of a semi-retirement gig, and he goes, "I get on my steel bike. This is the ride I want."
Exactly.
So I think those are some of the things that are really affecting and driving people back to steel, is that you are now seeing a lot of the people who were leaders before now reacquainting themselves with bikes. The other phenomenon that's going on are young rebels. You know, for them, they've never been on a steel bike before. And steel is now exotic, and steel is something that they can find tangible. They can play with it. They can grind on it. There's a lot of people who take frame building classes, and you have a growing army of small frame builders out there. And these people are rebelling against technology. And so they're
anti-technology?
Well, we're talking about technology like, you know, should we have 5-speed, 10-speed, 15-speed, 20-speed, 30-speed? You know, where will the world end? We're going to have electronic shifting. How much do we need electronic shifting? Now, for a certain group of people, that's going to be that's great. That's going to be a growing business. But for people who are just riding in the city, sometimes one gear is all you need.
And that's going to probably be on a steel bike.
And it will probably be on a steel bike.
Right.
But not only, but it's, I think that questioning of technology as the source of everything is really key. The other thing that they've discovered is when they got that single-speed bike, in many cases, their starter bike is a 30- or 40-year-old steel bike.
Yes.
So when someone tells them that steel doesn't hold up because it rusts, they go, well, that's interesting. How many carbon fiber bikes do you see that are even 10 years old? And the answer is almost none.
Interesting. So your son, Tucker, is into bike polo.
Indeed.
All right. Let's hear it. What is bike polo exactly?
Bike polo has been around for a long time. And, in fact, the first manifestations of bike polo actually go back to the 1970s. And, in fact, we're building a new bike polo bike for a guy who was actually hand-built his own bike polo bike in the early 70s, Mark Mattea, Cycle Smithy in Chicago.
I know Cycle Smithy.
And it's a 20-inch front and rear-wheel bike polo bike is what we're building for him. It's a funny-looking bike.
Well, what makes it a polo bike?
Well, let's talk about what polo is.
Okay.
Polo is basically like soccer with a mallet. And it's just like polo on horses, except you're on bikes instead.
Oh, this sounds good and dangerous. All right.
Well, it does. There's a couple of twists. And when Mark Mattea was playing it back in the early 70s, they had essentially the same kind of ball that they used in horse polo, which is a hard ball, not a whole lot different than a baseball. Well, you get hit by one of those, that's going to hurt. And the mallet you need to hit a ball that big is also pretty big. So what's happened is the sport of polo has gone through a couple of evolutions and a couple of really meaningful changes. One is that it's a hard court. It's called hard court bike polo. And a polo court is about the size of a tennis court.
Oh, so you could actually take an existing tennis court and turn it into a polo court and just get rid of the net.
Bingo. And so what they do, and there are, you put nets at both ends that are just like soccer nets. And there are a series of rules, and there's a growing series of rules. This is an evolving sport. This is really very much of a grassroots sport. But it has some really tremendous advantages over other kind of competition cycling activities. For one thing, you don't have to close down a lot of streets in order to engage in a sport.
No, that's true. And you can have a nice captive audience.
And you can have it's easy to watch the game. I mean,
right.
if you're at a bike race, oftentimes you get to see about 5% of the bike race. And you really have to know what's going on on hardcore bike polo you can watch things develop.
How many people on a team?
Well,
or is it one on one?
There are 3-on-3 teams. But it turns out, in fact, there was a tournament in Chicago called the Benchminer Tournament. Just happened probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and Tuck was one of the organizers of this, where they used 7-on-7. So they're still experimenting with the format. But the other interesting thing is when you take a look at other sports like BMX racing or cyclocross or mountain bike racing, these sports, they happen outside, you get a lot of fresh air, but they do tend to tear up the turf.
Yes.
And so if you go to a cyclocross course after a race, especially if you're in like December, I mean, you go back there, it's a real wreck. The nice thing about hardcore bike polo is the worst you got are some skid marks. But outside of that, you've got a lot you've got essentially something that can be reused in a number of ways. So it's really friendly to the cities and the places that want to help support the growth of the sport.
So are there leagues or is there an organization that is sort of, you know, formulating rules and regulations?
Well, they're not very organized. So it's still
a disorganization.
It's still very much in development.
Okay.
But the other really nice thing about polo bikes is that they're actually pretty decent bikes to ride. Kids have been riding on, you know, the kids essentially ride on BMX bikes once they hit about age 12. A BMX bike is a wonderful bike for BMX racing. It's designed to work with that particular type of course, which is a very specific type of race course. Once you get off the race course, it's really hard to ride that bike. The seat is so low that it's a very uncomfortable riding position. The only time you get comfortable riding is if you ride standing up. And riding standing up is not the kind of thing you want to do for any kind of long distance. So if you want to ride 2 or 3 miles, it's really hard to ride on a BMX bike. On a polo bike, it's pretty easy. That bike isn't a whole lot different than any kind of single-speed bike that you'd ride in the city. And I think there's real potential that if we actually size bikes for that younger group, that can replace a lot of BMX bikes in the city and still give them something really cool to do.
So this is a freewheeling single-speed?
It would be for most people, they use freewheeling. They actually have brakes, thank goodness.
Yeah, I'm sure that the technical handling skills get really good with these young guys. Are there any girls involved in this?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
In fact, one of Tuck's teams is called Team Adorable. And it's a women's team. In fact, Tuck is very, very, very closely hooked into the whole women's side of the movement. In fact, there was a whole tournament down in Austin, Texas, about 6 weeks ago. That was a whole women's tournament. But it's actually a sport where women can compete with men.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Why shouldn't it just be a co-ed?
Well, you know, let's put it this way. The guys are perfectly happy to welcome the ladies.
Okay. That's good.
And I think everybody enjoys it. It's still a feel-good sport. It hasn't sort of hit that stride. It's a lot like where mountain bikes were in the late 1970s or early 80s. Nobody was that serious about it. You didn't really have bike racing. You
right.
had people having fun. And then the idea of a bike race was, well, let's just, you know, we're in Crested Butte, we'll ride over to Aspen, you know, we'll see who wins. But we don't care. You'll get a beer.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where bike polo is right now. There aren't any serious rules. I'm sure, like every sport, it'll probably evolve into that. Hopefully, it'll still be fun for the rest of us.
It sounds like fun. It sounds like a little bit of a younger person's sport, which would be good because you get youngsters off their bikes and into cars. Maybe this is a way to get them back on a bike.
Well, the reality is that, you know, cars are becoming less affordable in today's society.
Good point.
And, you know, if we want to make America a livable place, we've got to find a way to be able to live well on less money. Bikes are a wonderful way to do that.
Because that, of course, is the next subject, and that is how you see bicycles in today's society changing the way people think about transportation.
Well, you know, there's, you know, what bicycles can do for the quality of life in America is really significant. You know, when you think about bike racing and cross-strait tours like the Ragbri Tour, what is it, Tosrov?
Yep,
Ohio.
We have Tosrov. Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are just the tip of the iceberg about what bikes can do. And I think most attitudes are really changing about bikes as a mode of transportation, and it's happening around the world. It's progressed more quickly over in Europe because Europe has suffered from congestion and high gasoline prices. They have real gas taxes over in Europe. We charge 18.4 cents a gallon to pay for the Highway Trust Fund. By the way, that 18.4% is roughly 25% of the actual cost of maintaining our roads.
Yes.
It is almost a token payment.
It is. There's no question about it.
In Germany, that number is $4.
And rightly so.
Well, you and I happen to agree on that.
I know that it's you know, we've built our society on this infrastructure of highways and bridges and roads, but things are changing. And, boy, people are kicking and screaming, but I think it's going to change anyway.
Well, it's kicking and screaming, but, you know, we are spending about $300 billion a year in military costs to assure that we have gasoline. That's the cost of having our Middle East presence. That is the reason why we are in the Middle East, is to ensure that we have good gas prices. We have no provision to pay for that. Interestingly enough, half of our balance of payments deficit, $300 billion a year, goes to paying for the gasoline that we have to send our soldiers into harm's way in order to get. And yet, there's no tax. So until we start to realize that gasoline that we need to pay for our roads out of. The cars need to pay for the roads that they use, and they need to pay for the guns to defend the supplies of oil. Then we'll start to see a more rational economy, and lots of good things will happen. It's already happened over in Europe, where they recognize the need to tax gasoline, change that balance, and invest in cycling infrastructure. In places like in some of the northern European cities, Amsterdam,
right,
and places like that,
Copenhagen,
Copenhagen, you're talking about 40% of bicycle trips, or of trips being taken on a bicycle,
right.
And that's making a huge impact on the quality of life and the cost of living well in those countries. And we're not talking about places that are sunny and warm and pleasant. We're talking about pretty much some of the nastiest weather in Europe.
No, that's true.
When you
Good
take
point.
A look at bicycling in this country, you'll find that Minneapolis is probably the most bike-friendly big city in the country. Oh, let's talk about good weather, huh?
Yeah, right. Freezing
and
cold weather.
Minneapolis's weather is probably slightly worse than Cleveland.
Oh, well, I'll bet we could be in a really good race for first place when it comes to that this year.
Woo. If they can do it in Minneapolis,
they can do it anywhere.
They can do it in Cleveland.
That's exactly right. Well, Richard, as always, you are just full of everything interesting to talk about: bicycles, the economy, gas tax. I know you are well-educated, well-read, witty, fun, and I'm going to come see you up in Madison at the Heartland Velo Show.
Indeed.
So we can continue our conversation, and we're going to bring you back on the Outspoken Cyclist, too. How's that?
That's great. I love you. With any opportunity to hang out with you, this is great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great evening. Would you say hello to everybody at Waterford?
I will.
All righty.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed this encore presentation of two of my all-time favorite interviews. I enjoy all of our guests, but sometimes these veteran cycling folks just take it up a notch. Please join me again next week for a brand new broadcast of The Outspoken Cyclist. And don't forget to go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.